You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
My guest tonight is Emmanuel Mayberg. Emmanuel is a veteran technology journalist and one of the founders of 404 Media, a digital media company exploring the ways technology is shaping and is shaped by our world. Emmanuel has written extensively about recent developments in the AI sector. Thanks for joining us, Emmanuel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So to start out, the term artificial intelligence, or AI, has been around since the 1950s. Encompasses a broad array of technologies. When we hear this term used today in the news, what technology does this term exactly refer to?
That's a very good and complicated question without an easy answer. I think what's important for people to keep in mind is that, as you said, AI is a pretty old term, at least in the realm of technology. And I would say it's kind of an umbrella term that refers to a wide array of various technologies. The reason we talk about it today and the thing that you and I are probably going to talk about the most is called LLMs, which are large language models. And this refers to a technology which essentially gobbles up huge amount of data, written data. So this is books, scientific papers, news articles, basically anything that was ever posted to the internet. And a piece of software crunches all of that data and then is able to statistically give you a written response that is most likely to match the prompt or question that you ask it. So a tool that most people are probably familiar with is OpenAI's ChatGPT. You ask it a question, it crunches all of that data, basically a significant portion of all of human knowledge. And then in the same way, AI developers will probably hate me for making this analogy, but if you're typing on your iPhone, people are probably familiar with the experience of the iPhone suggesting what the next word should be. An LLM basically does that in a much more sophisticated and powerful way and is able to statistically predict what is the next most likely word, but for entire paragraphs and papers and even books.
Interesting. And does it discern sort of what information is correct or incorrect in the model, or is it just whatever there's the most of it assumes is correct?
It does the best job it could do to give you what is statistically the most likely combination of words for what you're looking for. So I wouldn't, it's not thinking in terms of like what is correct and what is incorrect. It is thinking in terms of, and probably thinking isn't the right term to use here either. It is automatically processing all the written text in its training data and giving you what is statistically the probable sentence, word, paragraph, paper, book that you're looking for.
Interesting. And so, you know, I think large is the key word when we talk about large language models. What is required to process all of this data that's out there?
So first there is the data itself, right? You need massive amounts of data, which researchers mostly get by scraping everything that's posted to the internet. And then you need a staggering amount of what people in history call compute, which is essentially the computing power you need in order to crunch all this data and train the AI model. The way this works these days at the most advanced labs or companies like OpenAI is that they have these huge data centers filled with chips that at this point are built specifically for this task. Most of them come from this company called NVIDIA that used to be known mostly for making GPUs, graphics processing units that people use to run 3D games. But they also happen to be very good for this task. And now this is a huge portion, the majority of their business is making the chips for these data centers that train these AI models.
Right. And so earlier this year, there was a Chinese startup called DeepSeek that launched a new generative AI chatbot based on their R1 model. And this sort of made a big stir in the tech world. Could you explain what DeepSeek accomplished and its significance?
So some time has passed, and I think the commotion that DeepSeek stirred up has calmed down a little bit. But what happened at the time was that DeepSeek, which is a company that is based in China, released an AI model that does the same thing that ChatGPT does and performs comparably. People, I think, will nitpick which model is better. The different models are better at different tasks, but it is on par, best in class LLM. And what was different about it is that the company that made it claimed that it trained the model with a fraction of the compute, all that training power, all the chips that the American companies use. They claim that they found a much more efficient way to do this. And if that is the case, that would in many ways upset the current paradigm of how we train AI models, and also where globally is the power center of the AI industry.
Yeah, and so I know that they made a big wave because NVIDIA's stock sort of plummeted after that, and I know that it hasn't quite recovered. Some other things I know is that I think Microsoft originally had planned to spend some, you know, tens of billions of dollars on data center and AI infrastructure worldwide, and they've kind of pared back those commitments. Was that a result of DeepSeek?
It's hard to say, and a lot of things have happened to the market since DeepSeek, and the market is down overall because of Trump's tariffs and a lot of uncertainty about what is happening in the United States politically. So it's hard to parse at this point why NVIDIA's stock is down from the very high that it was at, I would say, I don't know, 6 months ago. But definitely the stock took a downturn when DeepSeek was released, and other tech companies sort of fell with it. And the reason that happened is that let's say Elon Musk also has an AI company. It's called xAI, and he very proudly announced, I think it was last year, that he built the world's largest AI data center for training AI models, and that had some huge number of NVIDIA chips that he acquired specifically for this purpose. And this is the reason that NVIDIA's stock has risen so much since the generative AI boom, since the arrival of these LLMs, is that these are the best chips for training AI models. All these companies are competing for the top spot in this emerging new technology that they think is going to be very powerful, very important, and very profitable. And at the center of this gold rush is NVIDIA, which is essentially selling the shovels. These are the tools with which these companies are going to make the AI models. And there are other players, but it is by far the most significant one. So everybody's buying all the chips. They're building these huge data centers. And the paradigm that was established here in America is that the more chips, the better. The more chips you can get, the more training you can do, the more powerful the AI models are, the more useful they are, the more users you'll get, the more you'll able to monetize them and be the winner in this huge and allegedly very important AI race. If what DeepSeek said was true, and they found a way to create a model that is just as powerful as what OpenAI has made with all its chips, then it would prove that these companies don't need to buy as many chips as they've been buying, and therefore NVIDIA is not going to make as much money because its chips won't be as critical because people won't need as many of them. There are many issues with that theory that we can get into that were true at the time, and as time went on, I think some other reasons emerged to kind of cast doubt on this theory that would deflate NVIDIA's value.
Right. My understanding is that they were sort of a little bit cagey about the $500 million they initially claimed, and turned out that that was just for maybe some portion of the data set that they trained on. And I know that there were also some, they sort of deflated the number of GPUs they used during the process.
Yeah, so first let's take DeepSeek at its word and assume that they did actually find these much more efficient ways to train AI models. And it's true that companies don't need as many chips as they thought to make these products. If that was true, then I think, and a lot of people who are in the business or analyze the business think, that ultimately the American companies would still come out ahead because they have more money, they have more access to chips, and they would use the same efficiencies that DeepSeek discovered and would have both the efficiencies and the huge amount of chips and just would make even more powerful models. So that's sort of the first problem with this paradigm or with this theory. The other thing which you alluded to is that you would have to take DeepSeek at its word that this is the case. And as time has gone on, it seems like they weren't exactly transparent with the numbers. There was a little bit of fudging of the numbers. Another thing that happened is that OpenAI claimed that DeepSeek didn't get all of the training data for its model on its own. It did what is called in the AI industry, it's called distillation. So basically, rather than scraping all the data from the internet and processing it and finding out what is the valuable data and connecting it in a way that makes the AI model useful, they just use OpenAI to extract the information. They just talk to the existing ChatGPT model to get the information. So that's the distillation part of it. And then another thing that has happened is that since DeepSeek made this claim, there has been some reporting, forgive me, I don't remember the publication, it was either Bloomberg or Wall Street Journal or both, but essentially they did some reporting to suggest that DeepSeek smuggled the chips that they were not allowed to have. We should mention at this point is that because of this global race for AI supremacy, which the American government believes is very important for our economy and national security, the Biden administration put in a bunch of export restrictions that prevent NVIDIA from selling these type of chips to Chinese companies. And there has been reporting that since then that they smuggled those chips into China to train DeepSeek anyway. So a lot of that theory fell apart since the DeepSeek story came out.
Sure. And so, you know, we talk about this AI race between the US and China and these hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. You know, what exactly are these tech companies hoping to accomplish with this large investment in AI? I mean, do they have some plan to recoup their investment? And what exactly is that?
I mean, it's hard to talk about this without it sounding like science fiction, but that is basically what we're talking about. We're talking about incredibly powerful AI tools that are doing a huge portion of human labor would just be handled by AI. And as you can imagine, this would save a lot of money for companies to pay AI tools to do work that is currently done by human labor. They would pay a huge amount of money to OpenAI, Microsoft, Google in order to access these tools. Then there's a bunch of applications of AI tools that like everyday people would pay for. So AI is writing your emails, AI is planning your meals, AI is driving your car. AI, so it's like it's everything. Basically, it would be implemented into every level of our lives. So if you're a company that controls that technology or a huge segment of that market, you're kind of controlling the future of the economy.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm an engineer myself, and I sometimes use ChatGPT for some mundane type tasks with Microsoft Excel to, you know, and I offload my time to do maybe more valuable work. But, you know, you wrote about a recent study that Microsoft did about the detrimental effects of on human cognition about offloading these kinds of tasks to AI. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Microsoft, researchers at Microsoft, as well as researchers at Carnegie Mellon University, put out this research that essentially claimed that the use of generative AI at work makes people who use generative AI use less critical thinking during their job. It's an atrophying of critical thinking is what they called it. And in order to study this, what the researchers did is they recruited 319 knowledge workers. So this is any type of worker you can imagine that can do their work at a computer, basically. Kind of like the work that you and I are doing. And they had them self-report 936 firsthand examples of using generative AI in their job, and then asked them to complete a survey where they asked them how did they use the AI and how confident they are in the generative AI tool's ability to do specific tasks and how confident they are in evaluating the AI's output and how confident they are in their abilities of completing the same work without the AI tool. And what they found is there's a direct relationship between how confident people are in the results that the AI tool is giving them and how much critical thinking they use during their job. And the more people are confident in the AI tool, the less critical thinking they use. And the inverse is true. The more people are confident in their own ability to do the job, the more skeptical they are of the results the AI tool is giving them, and the more critical thinking they use when examining the output that they get from the AI tool.
I see. So someone who already has like a background on a subject maybe would use AI as some kind of assistant, that they're sort of overseeing instead of having it actually do their work for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, all these people have experience and knowledge about the thing they are doing because it's their job. It's more about how confident they are in their own ability and how confident they are in the AI tool's ability. And that's sort of the give and take there.
And what kind of jobs were these? Could you give a couple examples?
Yeah. There's a teacher who used an AI image generator called DALL-E to create images for a presentation about hand washing at schools. There was a commodities trader who was using ChatGPT to, quote, generate recommendations for new resources and strategies to explore to hone my trading skills. Essentially, they were using ChatGPT to train themselves to become better at their job. And then there was also a nurse who, quote, verified a ChatGPT-generated educational pamphlet for newly diagnosed diabetic patients. So I think that part of the research was actually pretty interesting, and the most shocking to me is how many people they found who were using AI tools during their jobs. And these are critical jobs: commodities trader, teacher, nurse. So I think it also shows that the use of these tools is also very widespread at this point.
Right. So I think in your article, you also mentioned something about how, you know, there have been technologies developed in the past that have allowed us to offload cognitive tasks to free us up maybe from, in order to perform maybe more critical thinking. And you used an example of the cell phone for that. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about these AI tools. I'm sure most people don't use them yet or don't use them regularly. So this might sound pretty theoretical and weird, but if we go back in time, I'm old enough to remember a time before cell phones, or before I had a cell phone on me at all times. And back then, I remembered all these phone numbers. I remembered my home phone number. I remember my best friend's phone number. I remember my parents' job phone number. All these things, I kept them in my head. And as soon as we got smartphones, our ability to do that has atrophied. I don't remember any phone numbers now. I remember my phone number, and that's about it. I find that the same is true for my ability to navigate a city. So when I first moved to San Francisco, I had a cell phone by then, but smartphones weren't very widespread. So I just learned how to navigate the city by having a pocket map on me, and day by day, just learning a little bit more. And then when I moved to a new city, when I was older and had a smartphone, I just relied on Google Maps, and I kind of like never really learned the city in the same way. So maybe people are familiar with that. And the researchers are aware of this and recognize that there's a long history of this. I mean, I believe it was Greek philosophers, maybe it was Plato specifically, who thought the same thing about writing as a technology, like the ability to write stuff instead of having to memorize it and keep it all in your head at the same time was kind of a crutch and was atrophying a different kind of skill. So all of this in order to say that this is not necessarily inherently bad thing. It's not that these generative AI tools are inherently bad. It's just a shifting of the cognitive work. The way the researchers put it is the cognitive effort in some cases is shifting from task execution to oversight. And what they are concerned with is keeping that oversight critical, to not lose our critical thinking capacity while we're doing that.
So a lot of your reporting has focused on the proliferation of so-called AI-generated slop. Could you explain what this refers to?
AI-generated slop is a term that has been adopted in the last 2 years to describe the avalanche of low-quality AI-generated content that has flooded the internet. This can be images posted to Facebook. This could be AI-generated news articles on the internet. It's just any type of content that is low quality and AI-generated.
And maybe could you give an example of how this type of content is sort of seeping out of the internet and into the real world?
Yeah, I think I recently wrote a story about public libraries and how they are starting to see AI-generated books appear in their catalogs. And the way that this is happening is public libraries, if they want to allow their patrons to access ebooks, they usually use one of two companies. There is one company called Hoopla and one company called Overdrive, which listeners might be familiar with because of their app Libby, which is very popular. And these are kind of the two companies that dominate the space. They work with libraries to provide them with the ebooks that then people can lend out. And with Hoopla specifically, the issue is that librarians, when they collect physical books for the libraries, that's a big part of their job. They're picking and choosing which books they think will be most useful and most desirable for their community. With Hoopla, you don't get to be that selective. Hoopla has a huge catalog of books, of ebooks, and also music and movies as well. You have to opt into it or not. You pay a fee to have your library access Hoopla as a service. And then every time a patron lends an ebook from Hoopla via your library, the library pays a small fee for that. And what I've discovered after talking to librarians and investigating this catalog myself is that it's filled with these low quality AI generated books, or AI slop as we call it.
And so I know that the AI slop books, I know, kind of run the gamut from mundane to almost dangerous. Could you give an example of one of those?
Yeah, so some examples that I found, so a mundane one, but I would say one that would probably be annoying to a patron or a librarian, is a low-quality AI-generated biography of Elon Musk. So let's say you're a teenager, you're interested in space travel, you're interested in this person who's in the news. You go into Hoopla, you type in Elon Musk, and a bunch of books come out, and you pick one of them because you're like, oh, this one has a nice cover. But then when you get home and you use your ebook reader, you realize that this is like a very low quality book. It's short. It has very basic information that looks like it was lifted from Wikipedia, because it probably was. Then you're upset. You tell the librarian that they have a bad book in their catalog. The librarian is upset because they wasted your time and then also wasted taxpayer dollars, right? Because they had to pay for you to lend that book. But I would put that in a not very harmful category. Another example of a book I saw is it is a recipe book for people with a fatty liver. And it's just 500 or so recipes in a book that are AI generated. And I didn't find myself any recipe that was dangerous or would harm someone who has a fatty liver and needs to take care of that and eat a specific diet. But I have done some other reporting about AI generated recipes, and you get the same kinds of mistakes there that you can get with any AI generated content. So in theory, you could be looking for pretty important information, get something that is AI generated, and get bad, harmful information. I didn't find these books in the library, but we have done some other reporting on AI generated books on Amazon. And one really dangerous example there is AI generated books on mushroom foraging. So you want to do some mushroom foraging, you're in the forest, you're looking for mushrooms that are safe to eat, and an AI-generated book about mushrooms might just give you the wrong image or the wrong name or the wrong description of a mushroom, and that could be deadly.
Yeah, that's scary stuff. Well, thanks so much for coming on tonight, Emmanuel. Really appreciate it. If our listeners want to learn more or read your writing, where can they find you?
404media.co is where you can find all our work. Check us out.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on Radio Literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. Well, I'm glad to be back with you. I've been away for 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm raring to go. Let's see, our engineer, as always, you, well, hasn't been here very long, but Daniel MacArthur. And then we have a special guest today.